to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty, and justice for all.
Before I turn the floor over to Mr. McGovern, do you have any comments, or is that format sound all right to you?
I have a question.
All right, go for it.
I want to make sure I've got the right list. I think there are two lists circulating. Okay.
Is this list different than what was attached to our agenda for consideration?
It is.
So there's been more changes since our last meeting?
That I'm not sure.
Yeah. Do you have 10?
Pat, you have a comment? Yeah, absolutely.
My list has 17 items on it.
To our packet last week.
May I have a copy of it? I've got it.
Like seven on here.
Can I get an extra one for Hatch?
And can we get one for Kavanaugh? Do you have enough?
You need me to go make another copy? Okay. Thank you.
May I assume that the first point is definition of redevelopment? May I assume that's the case?
Yes, yes.
All right. If you would clarify your point and allow the staff to respond.
Background. I've 10 points, and that is where we started. My first involvement with this project was December 21st. We then sat down. We went through a meeting, about an hour. And we got to a point where, at least in concept, we were very close on all of the 10 items with the exception of one. And that had to do with who was going to maintain the facilities themselves. Since that time, there has been a lot of discussion, between myself and Kavanaugh, a lot of internal discussion to try to refine this list and to try to come to some consensus. Now, I recognize that's been a difficult process because of the various players that are involved. I mean, there are different interests involved, and so we have tried, even on this side, to try to come to some consensus. I'll go through these briefly. I would encourage questions or discussion if you have any questions, and then try to work through whatever we can. The issue with respect to the definition of redevelopment, this has to do with what date is going to be included. It says, as one of the exceptions, is on a site that has not been subdivided after a date. Now, what has been proposed by staff is that date is going to be the effective date of the ordinance. Our concern with this is that if you have property, and you may have some that is in the pipeline right now to be subdivided, if that process has not been completed, by the date the ordinance becomes effective, I now effectively have taken property from somebody. I may have somebody who has a two-acre site. They may want to subdivide that such that they're going to have 0.8 acres. They'll have 1.2 on the other side. And now I can no longer do that. What otherwise would be exempt is now going to be subject to all of these provisions because I didn't complete the process by a date certain. What we had proposed is to put a date sometime into the future on that so that the effective date with respect to that exception on when the property had to be subdivided was going to be 6 months out, 5 months out. That was something we were willing to discuss. The concern that we heard back from the city is that if we do it that way, if we pick a date sometime in the future, the concern was that there was going to be a large influx of applications to try to get the property subdivided in a timely fashion, to try to get it in, to somehow try to avoid the requirements of the ordinance. In all fairness, if in fact I subdivide the lot and I do subdivide it such that I have 0.8 acres, I am within the exception. I'm less than an acre. And I've done those things. I'm not circumventing anything. I have simply given the property owner time in which to complete the subdivision of their lot if in fact that's what they intended to do. I would be surprised in the current environment that if this happened and we gave them at least some period of time by which to do it, that there's going to be a large influx of applications.
What date? 6 months?
We had suggested 6 months. And I say we, this would have been the group that I am speaking on behalf of.
So if the ordinance is passed Monday, you propose 6 months from the date of that passage of that ordinance?
Relative to the time period by which the lot would need to be subdivided. Now, there's two concerns we have, and I think some of these would be also concerns of the city. If, in fact, that I have submitted an application to subdivide my lot, and I'm already in the process of doing that, that property owner certainly has the argument that they're vested in the process. The way the ordinance would read now is that upon the effective date, I now have to comply. Even though I may have subdivided my lot to 0.8 acre, I've now increased the cost of my project by $30,000 to $50,000. I've now got a lot that I can no longer develop. Again, we are simply trying to provide property owners, developers, contractors with an opportunity by which they can accomplish the subdivision if that's in fact what they're going to do. The argument, again, that we heard in response is the concern that too many applications will come in, too many parties will then try to request this exception effectively. Again, I think it is a problem. It's a problem from the city's perspective to do it in the manner in which it's happening and not providing the property owner the opportunity to come in, either complete the process they've started, or if they do have intentions to develop the property, to give them a lot, the opportunity to do the subdivision.
Staff, do you have any comments?
Sure. I think one of the issues is, and I did listen to what Brian had to say, and that's what you see in Section 2 of the ordinance. For a six-month period beginning on May 21st, 2012, stormwater management shall be provided at the option of the property owner, either under the provisions of the article in effect or the provisions of this article as they exist on May 20th, 2012. The issue there is, well, what can you do right now? Right now, you can't subdivide underneath an acre and become exempt. That's kind of the argument is, well, I should be able to do that. Well, you can't do it right now. So you can do whatever you do right now under the current ordinance for 6 months. It's your choice, or do the new one. I think most time it's actually going to be advantageous to use the new one, particularly if you're under an acre for redevelopment, because then you're going to be exempt. So I don't see that there is an issue of something worse is happening. Actually, something better is happening. Now, there may be a few cases where that's not true, and so I did listen to what the whole point was, which was for those people in the pipeline where the old one would be better, that's why we added in the Section 2.
Response?
Still doesn't provide the opportunity for those who may develop the site. If, in fact, I'm going to enact an ordinance that effectively is going to take away my ability to develop the site, at the very least, due process should provide me with an opportunity to subdivide the property if I intend to. I guess my example is probably the best argument I can make. I own 2 acres. If I'm going to subdivide that into 0.8 and 1.2 acres, I intend to develop that 0.8-acre site. Under the ordinance as it is written, I am less than an acre. I would be exempt from the requirements of the ordinance itself. But because I haven't done it by an arbitrary date certain, I now have increased the cost of that project by $30,000 to $50,000. And effectively, my ability to develop that site is no longer there. The way it is being proposed now is there is going to be the date, and I think the language says, upon the effective date of the ordinance. If you haven't subdivided, you're out.
The issue is if the ordinance never passes, right, and you were to do just what he said right now, you'd be subject to the ordinance. So it's not a loss. It's a gain.
What's the typical time it takes to subdivide through the city process? Who would know that?
That's a roughly a 3-month process. That's, you know, a straightforward issue without any complications.
Right. Yeah. That's why we suggested the 6, because of some in which there's going to be some complications and issues.
So the problem with putting 6 months out on this is what?
If there isn't a problem with putting 6 months out. The question is do you have what you have today, and then, or do you have something more than that? If you're granting something more than that, you're basically creating a loophole for 6 months versus having what you have today. So if you go out, this is what the regulation would be. Or for some few small cases, it may be better to have the old regulation. So the compromise in my mind of what I tried to create was, after listening, was, okay, you can use both for 6 months. Pick the one that's best for you. That should prevent the problem that Brian's talking about. If I have something in the pipeline, although I don't know that vested rights really goes to police powers, but that's a whole other topic. But that should at least give 6 months for this to work out.
Mathis, any comments?
I have to make this simpler for city managers.
Yeah.
The way I thought about it, we sort of talked on April 2nd about a pipeline. Allow folks to finish, if they're in the pipeline, allow them to finish under the old rules or the new rules, depending on which scenario. So I felt like this Section 2 is kind of an ingenious way to do it. It's their choice. Which set of rules do they want? For the next 6 months, you can choose the current rules or you can choose the new rules. It's up to you. And, but you know, after 6 months, it's the new rules that would apply. So I think your point, if I'm understanding it, is that's the sticking point.
Yes.
You don't want the new rules to apply as a date certain.
As of that date certain. It's just simply picking the date of the effective date. I mean, as somebody mentioned, you've been at this for 3 years. And now I'm going to have a date by which it's going to hit the agenda. It's going to have an effective date. And now it's that's it. That's the concern, as compared to giving at least notice to people out there. And this will be in the paper, whether they read it or not, is then certainly an argument the city has to say, wait a minute, you had adequate notice. There was public notice of the meeting. It was in the newspaper. It was reported what has happened. And there is some period of time by which I can do what I may want to do with the property. Now, I had heard part of the concern was, again, that there would be this significant influx of applications, people trying to come in and do this. Now, there are a variety of other requirements that a developer has before he can get that permit to build or develop that particular site. But our concern with this one is because that date is just going to happen whenever this actually hits the agenda, that it just simply isn't fair. We suggested some notice, a period of time by which that would become effective.
If you can't do it now, how is it taking?
Well, the issue, if you took the position that I simply can't do it now, that I'm somehow getting something, well, then that would assume the ordinance is never coming in place. The ordinance is going to come in place, and the rules are going to change. And so it's difficult to make that argument that, well, I'm getting something more. That would be true if this isn't going to happen, but it is. And there's a variety of other requirements. There's other language contained within the ordinance, many of which, and much of the language, I think provides the protection the city is looking for, and I think accomplishes what you're trying to accomplish with the stormwater plan.
Are we discussing this as a council?
Yeah,
so
you're doing? I'm just wanting to know what they're recommending. You're recommending that this go and enforce 6 months.
Yes, just that, not this, not the ordinance, just that part of it.
All right.
On subdividing lots.
All right. So, you guys are not going to agree.
Right.
So we'll put that down as somebody may choose to make an amendment to that, and we'll vote it up or down. Next point.
The second issue involved the definition of the term site. Now, the initial problem with the definition that was included by staff was that it included the word ownership. There was some concern with respect to the groups that I represent that by including that, an argument would be made by the city that if, in fact, I am developing Site A, that I could obligate an adjoining piece of property which had similar ownership to comply with the best management practices stormwater requirements. There was discussion about that at the December 21st meeting, and at least as of that time, the discussion was, well, why don't we simply use definitions contained within either federal or state regulations? That if, in fact, we can demonstrate we're in compliance with state or federal regulations or statutes, that we could go with those definitions. So we did that. We included within the proposal that we originally sent back definitions contained within the federal regulations of the definition of site, and then because the definition also included the terms facility or activity, we then included that definition. Now, Kevin and I have talked a lot about that because at least as of the December meeting, we thought that was a way to resolve it, that we could use those definitions so that if the city was ever challenged, the city could simply look back to what the federal regulations require. Since that meeting, there was some concern. I mean, there was an issue involving Hinkson Creek. I understand there was an issue with the EPA, and Kavanaugh expressed some concerns about that. And so what we effectively did is in those discussions, Kavanaugh then came back to the original definition. I don't mean to speak to you, so correct me whenever I say something not correct.
No problem.
And then we talked about, well, what can we do? The concern was reference within the definitions to something that may impact the settlement involving the EPA. Kavanaugh's suggestion was to pull out the term ownership so that that argument couldn't be made. We had suggested, again, because we had gone full circle on our side, to simply including those federal definitions that were contained within the ordinance. So practically speaking, I don't think on this issue we're that far apart. It's just a question of which definitions we're going to use.
Let me talk about a few things first. One has to do with the way that the facility and activity is defined in the federal definition, which was the warning flag to me, was it had to do with any NPDES point source, and then it also has any other facility or activity, so it circles itself back to point source. Well, one of the issues with the TMDL is we're being regulated for non-point source. And we also include on our ordinance one of the purpose clauses is that to try to minimize non-point source. So to add that definition the way it was with that facility activity not only is conflicting, it's not how we're actually being regulated under the TMDL, which obviously makes me pretty concerned. So to try to get away from that, what you get back to is the other thought was, well, if we take away ownership, that will help. Here's one of the fundamental underlying issues, I think, is it's what is part of a larger common plan of development or sale, and these arguments kind of about that have been happening. And the issue there is, as well, just because I own the land next door, does that make it part of that common development or sale? And the problem really becomes is this isn't going to really truly resolve the issue. It's just going to take the word ownership and that ownership out of it. So it may be harder to prove common development or sale without the ownership connection. But I don't think it's going to solve all these fights about whether or not that's a common plan, a scheme of development for sale or not. And I'll give you an example. You have the Poor Oldle property that just burnt down right now. And then you have there was a proposed development right across the street, and then you had a parking garage associated with all those developments. Well, is that a common plan of development or sale? Well, probably, yeah. But necessarily, would it be under the same LLC or a different LLC or however the mechanisms to fulfill that would be? If it was the same ownership, it might be easier to show that that's a common scheme of development or not. But taking that out, you just have to show it in a different way. But I don't think it ends the argument about this common scheme of development or plan.
The other thing I'd say is that this is very specific in the way it's described today and what it's an enforcement for us. And that helps us in enforcement that it is specific. And so we know what these are. It's been that way since 1993 when 12A was introduced. So it's been there 20 years just in this description. The other thing that I would say is that its site is in 12A 70 plus times. It describes site. So if you change the definition, you've effectively changed 12A totally.
The reason the change was made was at the request of the city.
It was, but we weren't under the impression where activity was going to come in and point out a point source.
Well, the original request was based on feedback from the Stormwater Committee and at a meeting, I think, from the County Development Council kind of advocating for that. I mean, our original changes were just add S's on the end. I mean, if you can see those that were marked up. My compromise to go back is I thought, oh, yeah, we use the federal definition. That will work great. That seemed reasonable, right? Well, the problem was when he found the facility and activity was part of that definition to include it, which you should need to do, that's not how we're being regulated. Now, whether or not that's right or wrong at the federal level, I can't really answer that, but I know how we're being regulated here locally. And I'm not looking to get us into trouble. So then I thought, well, I can't do that, but I can at least try to go back to the compromise of do the ownership. I don't think it's going to cure all the problems, but I think it may help with some of them.
The problem that we ran into with respect to the common plan, scheme of development, or in terms of, put up for sale, there was concern that if, in fact, I have, again, the development, and there was a specific example given, and I'm developing a particular lot, I have common ownership of a lot next door, even though that lot next door is not part of that project, can I require them to follow the same standards? Do I require them to construct the BMPs that would be required on the other projects simply because of this common ownership? And we had discussions about that at the meeting, that if, in fact, you get bogged down as to what is common ownership, what if I have different partners, different members, and it's not truly part of the common planner scheme, then it should come out. That argument needs to be taken out of the ordinance, which I think at this point that has been addressed. Kavanaugh is correct. The reason for the change was because there was concern that this definition didn't have any support. Much of what we talked about at that meeting was find us support as to, within the federal regulations or state statutes, such that if we're ever challenged, we have someplace we can look to demonstrate this is where the definition came from. That's why that definition was included. Now, we're trying to work through that. The ownership language, that word, has been taken out. I mean, we certainly have discussed even the idea of defining or including within the definition of site the disturbed area, because you're going to see, and there is language that is now contained within the ordinance that talks a lot about that. I mean, we have agreed that the contractor will, in fact, stake the area that's going to be disturbed so that staff can readily determine if, in fact, it's less than an acre. We've also agreed that if, in fact, a site plan is required, that we will designate on that site plan where the disturbed area is going to be. We could put that within this definition as well, that site includes that disturbed area. But from the standpoint of defending that definition, other than the fact that you may have had it for 20 years, I can't defend it.
Well, what definition do you want?
We had included the definitions that were from the federal regulations. Now, we could potentially go with the definition that excludes the word ownership, and if we then include within that definition that what we're talking about, and we talk about site, because that's it is used throughout the ordinance, we're talking about the disturbed area.
Comment, Kavanaugh?
They are asking for two different things. I tried to adjust.
I will tell you this. If you want us to debate this Monday night, you're going to have to have very specific amendments for
we
us
have.
Today.
And you have the language. I'm at this point trying to see if, as I understood, the work session is to try to work through some of these. We have submitted federal definitions of which I am not suggesting a change. I can't change them because if I do, I can't defend them.
So I guess my comment is I'm, for the reasons I explained earlier, I'm troubled by those federal definitions. I think that may get us into more trouble because that's not how we're being regulated. So I was willing to compromise to the ownership one, which is a different thing that was requested, versus just my changes, which was just the S's.
Okay. Next point.
The next one is one that is referred to, I guess, is best described as the duplex issue. And what you have within the exceptions is reference to single-family residents. The background is this, is what is going to be included, what is not going to be included within those exceptions. We have talked about this at great length. Why we've called it the duplex provision really isn't anything more than a discussion of how do we define the structure within this particular provision of the ordinance. It talks about single-family residences, farmland, and domestic gardens is what staff has recommended. Stormwater advisory, as well as the other groups that I am here speaking on behalf of, have talked about attached and detached single-family homes. Now, where this comes from is out of the state regulations. Within 10 CSR 20-6.200 stormwater regulation, the state has identified those exceptions within their regulation. One of them is it speaks in terms of land disturbance activity on an individual residential building lot is not considered as part of the overall subdivision. So the language, the key language that we have been talking about is single-family residential lot. Now, the question I think that is presented is that is describing the structure or is that describing the lot itself? Now, we have gone back and forth on that issue in great deal. What we have asked for is duplexes. In my conversations with Kavanaugh, it was more of an issue, well, you have to find some support. Give me some basis upon which can we make the distinction. Because how do I defend the claim from the developer who comes in with an 8-unit project, 16-unit project, and says, why is that one, the duplex, exempt, and this one is not? So we look for that. And one of the things that I look to is to try to find some provision within the Missouri statutes that would give us some guidance as to what is and what is not residential versus commercial property. Two examples that I did provide, and Kevin and I have talked about this. One is within the mechanics lien statute. Now, within 429.013, which is the Missouri mechanics lien law, it says the provisions of this section shall apply only to the repair or remodeling of or addition to owner-occupied residential property of 4 units or less. Now, that is simply a distinction that the legislature made as to where do we draw the line between commercial versus residential. My purpose in providing that to Kavanaugh is that if, in fact, a claim came, how do I defend it? Well, I defend it by showing the statutes in which the legislature has decided that four units is the one. Kavanaugh expressed some concerns. Well, that's talking about the mechanics lien law. That's talking about notice. You can also take a look at 431-180, which is a provision of Missouri statutes, a chapter called General Provisions as to Contracts, Section 431-180. Within that Section 3, it says the provisions of this section shall not apply to contracts for private construction work for the building, improvement, repair, or remodeling of owner-occupied residential property, 40 units or less. Same language appears. In addition to that, we have had conversations with other, both Kavanaugh and I have tried to get further guidance from the DNR, but that is a letter they're simply not going to write. We also looked at this purely from the standpoint of what's the statute say. I mean, any time I'm going to be considering statutory construction or regulatory construction, I look at all the terms. I try to provide them with plain and ordinary meaning. And what I have is individual residential building lot. I think it's descriptive of the lot. Otherwise, they wouldn't have chosen to put the word lot in there. We did, again, for purposes of providing support, if in fact the city was challenged, provided the statute. And I wanted to go beyond just the mechanics lien law, so we went to the general provisions on contracting in 431, and you find the same distinction. So really, from the standpoint of determining how do I defend this, where do I draw the line, I don't think that regulation is descriptive in any way of the structure. It's describing the lot. We're suggesting we could do four units. And now I have a statute that specifically says owner-occupied residential property, four units or less. So that's the issue. The issue, do we say single-family residence, which would suggest just a home, or could it be a duplex? Could it be a quad?
Why not?
Well, I know single-family residence is exempt from a different portion of the chapter. So when I was looking at this, one first thing you had to understand is that this is a exception, not an exemption. It's qualified by its own terms, okay, so that there has to have some criteria to go with it. It's not completely exempt. You have to have this language of it says, which is as part of the overall subdivision, unless the activity is by the developer to improve the lot for sale. So it does have criteria that must be required before it kicks in. The other issue is that I actually think single family covers more, and what I think they're trying to get at here is zero lot line housing that are single family. I think what that is you can have a two families that have a zero lot lines and they each have separate lots. That I think that what this is saying is those are still single family. The same thing is with townhouses. You could have lots that you could tear down the middle one and not be affected by stormwater because they're each on separate residential lots. They're still single family. And to me, that's what single family was. Single family is a complete exemption versus an exception. So then the issue came was, well, I tried to figure out a way to solve this problem. And so what I had originally done is I'd sent it from where it was exempt in B to where it was an exception, where if it was underneath an acre, then basically you could have a duplex or this very language I also added later to try to meet this thing where, okay, if it's underneath an acre, you can just do it. Because I know we can exempt, as long as it's not a common scheme of development, underneath that acre. So that's how I tried to solve the problem by putting it over in a different place. An additional issue comes up, and also, by the way, the federal government requires you to, if it's a common scheme of development or if it's over in an acre, to regulate it. So if there's a gap here, it's a very, very narrow one that we're missing. And further, the issue is it's the state statute's not that clear, so we try to clarify it. John sent a letter to DNR with these questions saying, please help us, and, of course, we did not get a response. I think you'd ask some people the same questions and no response.
They'll respond, they just won't write it down.
One of the other issues is DNR has a clause that goes over these exceptions that says if any of the operations exempted should cause pollution of the waters of the state or otherwise violate the Missouri Clean Water Law or these regulations, they can just say you can't do it. We don't have anything equivalent to that, so it's hard to then cover a misstep here. And it's certainly not the clearest thing that's written in all the world. I'm not even sure with the first sentence, whether the first sentence is supposed to go for the whole provision because it does talk about the 1 acre of total land area, which is not part of the common plan or sale. So considering all those things, I thought, well, it does talk about the lot, but I was referencing the single family to include more than just what we typically think of as a single family. I'm talking about the zero lot line properties would be included in the exemptions, whereas otherwise, if you're just talking a duplex or fourplex, what my fear is that you have the Grove, for example. That's one residential lot. I don't think anyone believes that that's exempt from stormwater. But the argument is well, where do you draw this line and how do you draw it all the way down to what I'm talking about? And I think it's very difficult to do. So that's how I tried to address the concerns, but by exempting duplexes underneath an acre, or I included that same language that says residences and land disturbances of individual residential building lots underneath 1 acre, we're still covering the vast majority of where I see the problems would come up.
The problem is that the definition, at least that has been relied upon, doesn't talk about single-family residence. If they would have stopped within the definition right there, within the exception right there, I'd understand the argument. But it says individual residential building lot, and it's going to be very difficult to argue that that is not descriptive of the site and that is somehow descriptive of the structure. Now, Kavanaugh's concern, and I appreciate it, well, where do I draw the line? Well, I think the legislature has given us that assistance, and the legislature has said, you want to know the difference between residential versus commercial, it is owner-occupied residential property of 4 units or less. That is certainly something you could defend. It is something, a definition by which the legislature uses multiple times within Missouri statutes, not simply within the mechanics lien law, but also some of the general provisions. Now, from the standpoint of what the water law in Missouri says, there are certainly provisions within the water regulations that dictate what the DNR can do within the enforcement division. From the standpoint of what we have here is nothing more than how do we define that? If, in fact, I'm going to rely upon the terms individual residential lot as an exception, how do I make the distinction of simply saying single-family residence? When I think in many examples, you can demonstrate that, in fact, the roof area, the square footage of the duplex, is, in fact, going to be smaller than the single-family residential home. Now, the quadplex, the idea of having 4 units, we simply are suggesting that because if, in fact, what we are looking for is a defensible position, I've got multiple references within the statutes that make the distinction.
It really gets back to individual residential building lot. So if an individual residential building lot is a separate lot line and a family is living there, okay, I can defend that. I can also defend easily if it's underneath an acre. If it's an over an acre, common scheme of development is going to kick in anyway, and so it's going to really get caught up. So I think I've got a much better defensible position versus relying on, and I appreciate he got the nub for me to try to throw my hat at. I just don't think my hat will stick. So I appreciate what he did, but I tried to solve it in a different way, which I thought was more defensible.
So what you're asking for is the Stormwater Advisory Commission, attached and detached, single-family residences, that's the language you're looking for?
What we are talking about here is it talks about just single-family residence, and so what we were suggesting originally was attached and detached and further define that as a duplex. Now, I think to truly be defensible, the better way in which to define that would say owner-occupied or just residential units, 4 units or less. I think what they're talking about and what the regulation is referring to is the lot. I don't see how you could argue around that since the word lot is used within the regulation itself. So then how do I make the distinction? Why do I simply choose single-family residence? I understand if it's under an acre because we have that. I mean, we have that provision, and we had to work to some extent to get back to that point. So now we have, okay, less than an acre, which is consistent with both state and federal law, and now I've chosen single-family residence. How do I exclude the other? Where do I make the distinction?
When you presented these talking points, there's nothing that in this section that has what you're describing. I mean,
no, and so you know, Ms. Anthony, this was put together by the Stormwater. I represent the Stormwater Commission, but it does reflect the same issues. Many of the things that I'm talking about have been provided to the city previously over the last 6 months or so.
And you understand my frustration. I mean, I can't really exactly. I mean, it would be nice if we did have exactly what it is you were looking for the language. But
and that has been submitted.
I don't have. Not before us.
No, it's not right okay. At the work session. You're correct.
But that's what we're trying to knock out here. You understand the frustration I'm having here is I'm having trouble understanding your point of contention with Kavanaugh.
Point of contention is the way in which the exception is going to read is to simply say single-family residence. That's it. So that means a house. What we have suggested is we'd requested duplexes. Now, the concern was, as Kavanaugh has described it, is I can't defend that. How do I – give me some support for that. Give me something that we can defend our position if, in fact, we include duplexes. I think the defensible position is the statutes.
What I want to know is, can we include duplexes?
I don't think so as an exemption. I think as a exception, where I put it, under an acre, sure. And it's going to cover most things. Now, one of the things we did try to do as a amendment sheet manager, when we talked about it as another compromise, was to basically define attached single-family residence, and we took this out of the zoning code, which was a building containing two attached dwelling units that share a common wall at a lot line that are on separate lots. That would get you to your zero lot line structures that are duplexes. I could argue that is still single-family residence, but you could change the language and say attached. By defining attached single-family residence, then you can then make that work as another way to try to compromise it, but I think it's better the other way.
All right, let's move to the next point, applicability E87.
This has to do with a provision contained within 12A-87 that references in Section 2 incorporate water quality protection to the maximum extent practicable. Now, the concern, the issue, is the phrase maximum extent practicable. Now, where that comes from is within the federal regulations, Section 122.34, and the language says your NPDES permit, MS4 permit, will require at a minimum that you develop, implement, and enforce a stormwater management program designed to reduce the discharge of pollutants from your MS4 to the maximum extent practicable. Now, what that is an obligation that the federal regulations have imposed upon the city. The problem from the standpoint of the various groups I am representing is that the city simply says within its proposed language, incorporate water quality protection to the maximum extent practicable. So effectively, the obligation that was put on the city has simply been passed on to the developer, and there's no guidance as to what that means. And so the discussions that we have had, the recommendation we made, and the language that we submitted included reference to the stormwater manual. Now, we understood and had been told that that is being updated, and what we did was simply reference that obligation, which is now undefined, would become effective at such time that the manual itself had been updated, so that there is at least some guidance as to what that term means.
Kavanaugh?
Maximum extent practical is going to be dependent on each site. And as currently written, basically, we're talking about redevelopment over 1 acre now. Well, the redevelopment over an acre is going to go from 12% impervious to 100% impervious. That's the range of imperviousness. So what the city was trying to do in what's going to be some of the manual changes are give at least three different kinds of options for water quality. Well, when you give options, those options have to be used reasonably. So one of the issues is going to become what is reasonable for a 100% impervious site as an option, or what is the maximum extent practical, is probably going to be really different, obviously, than what's maximum extent practical for a 12% impervious site. So therefore, part of the critical aspect of it is you got to be reasonable how you do it. You know, we're giving you these options, and we're letting you select the ones you want, which I think is a good thing because it gives more flexibility. But you got to use that reasonably. That's why I left it in there. And there's things in our permit and other places besides just the federal thing that drive the maximum extent practical. Another issue is how can John grant a variance if there's not a maximum extent practical and it's all rigidly defined? Or the way other cities also have done it in the past is you just keep coming back to staff until staff lets you know when you've hit it. And I don't think we've ever done that here. We've used curve numbers and we've tried to, you know, give options and different ways to accomplish goals. And that's what we're trying to do is expand options.
The problem is, though, just what was described. I have a term. I've got a term that comes specifically from the federal regulations, which is an obligation upon the city to ensure that the requirements are done to the maximum extent practicable. Now, instead of defining that in some fashion or providing some guidance, the ordinance simply then says you, in turn, will do it to the maximum extent practicable.
How would you define it?
we were asking as to what the city's looking for. Now, in terms of, you can define that in terms of a variety of ways. I would defer to the engineer on specifically the best ways to do that, but there's nothing, you know, from the standpoint, and the concern is exactly what Kavanaugh just described. A plan is submitted, and they say, well, that's not quite there yet. And another plan is submitted, and I'm still not quite there yet. We had talked about, and the discussions at the meeting was that there was going to be something at some point within the stormwater manual that would provide the guidance, that would at least give the contractor some idea of what they needed to do. And so we were working towards that. The language we proposed referenced the stormwater manual. Instead, we've now come to this point where all of that is now out, and we're simply back to the reference to the term.
I think we create a lot of problems for the city if we are too rigid in this. This is an evolving area. We have a stormwater manual. We are updating it, and it concerns me if we, you know, really make this a very rigid situation, we expose ourselves to some significant liability. So very appreciative of the work staff's doing on this.
The problem that we have is we don't have anything from staff. I mean, we've got a term that comes specifically from the federal regulations that doesn't say the contractor shall do these things to the maximum extent practicable. What the regulation says, the city shall ensure that in its program it shall have these things done to the maximum extent practicable. And then that obligation was simply then passed on to the contractors, and they're looking for some guidance on that.
We have an ordinance and a manual and a staff that is ready to help and who hasn't been, as far as I know, at all obstructionist, and I just don't know what more you want. You want some rigid language that is going to hang us up as a city. I think it's dangerous.
And I don't disagree with that.
I have developed them. They're right here. It's part of the stormwater manual changes, which is what, you know, done by the director. I do have them. They're right here. They're minor. In general, so it's not that we don't have them. It's, you know.
And I don't know if, in all fairness, if those have been distributed yet, or if there's been comments.
Oh, they haven't, because we don't have an ordinance.
That may be what we're looking for.
All right, next. I think the intent is that we do precisely what you've mentioned, and that is, you know, mention the manual at this point, and then solve the, you know, provide some guidance in the manual for what that means. That is the intent of staff.
And it was certainly the discussion that took place at the meeting. And
I
didn't recall any disagreement at that point.
Okay, let's go to the next point.
The next one involves what I guess would best be described as a sunset provision, and this has to do with any stormwater plans that had been approved by September 4th of 2007. Would in fact as to how long do those plans remain effective. And so we've had some discussions with that. There has been various language proposed, and effectively this one also has come back full circle back to some of the original language that used to appear. What we are asking for with this is that there be stormwater plans approved prior to, there was a date originally proposed of January 1, 2012, would not expire until January 1, 2019. Now, what had been proposed previously is that, well, what happens if changes are made? Because we recognize that that could, in fact, affect that provision. It could affect the plan itself. And so there was language proposed. There were discussions about how do we gauge that. We're now back to very simply, it says that anything that had been approved prior to the 2007 date going forward would remain effective. But there's nothing that talks about what about, and this is really the question, if there is a minor change, something that isn't affecting the impervious space, something that isn't affecting the overall plan itself, again, as part of the discussions back and forth, any language that further defined what a change would entail was then removed. So the concern is, even if there is a minor change made to a plan that otherwise would have remained effective, what's the standard? What dictates when you have to go back and start the process all over again?
Okay, what this was is in my original comment, which the law allows for plans approved before the new regulations on September 4, 2007 to be completed. There's no corresponding exemption in the federal law or state law that would cover this concept, and no exception that the city can create really to cover it. Because what you're talking about is you're talking about a grandfathering vested rights issue. And it's an argument issue, because if it's a police powers issue, there really isn't a necessity to actually grant one. Now, you could argue whether or not that's a police powers issue, but the issue we really have going on is this is from the, we've had 5 years elapse since then. So if you've had a vested right, I didn't say you should get rid of it, because there may be some case out there that there really was a vested right underneath the facts, but I couldn't think of it. And so the issue you have is to expand this further is just creating more vested rights that aren't really necessary from the old change. So that's what I was saying is there may still be a case where you could prove it. I doubt it at this point 5 years later, but it's still possible. And then the original concept there was is you can either do it to your original stormwater management plan, or you could do it in accordance with the article. So you had a choice. You could either do it exactly as you submitted it, or you could do it under the new one. And that's how we were basically saying, you know, not even having the argument about whether or not you have a vested right or not, but saying, well, here's your choice. I just don't see how you can justify expanding it any further.
We're looking to expand it. The question was more further qualifying, describing, you know, what happens when I do make that minor change. When I've done nothing more than put a roof on, I've changed signage location, I've done something that otherwise is not going to affect what I originally intended to accomplish with the stormwater plan. We went through various drafts of language, and we have submitted language, which is still pending. And then the response was, well, effectively, we're going to go back to the language we had before. But again, how do I deal with the situation when the change that has been made has no impact on the overall plan itself? And that's where we were looking for some language. And then in terms of what that period of time would be post the effective date as to when these plans that had been previously approved would continue in effect.
How many plans are out there we're talking about? Do you have any idea?
No.
I know back in 07 we had an influx of plans to get under that date.
And some of those preliminary plats are going to be set to expire, which is, I think, why they're talking about the extra two-year date. But if you're talking about whether or not they took substantial steps to get those rights vested, I mean, that's more of what the mechanism I think they're originally trying to cover is somebody's getting ready, they've spent a lot of money, they're already building, you know, where does that end? I can't tell you exactly because it really depends on the facts.
But the substantial steps argument, and that's what Kavanaugh is referring to, is when you can determine whether or not somebody is vested within a particular project. How far down that path do I have to be before I have the ability to argue that I've got vested rights in that project? Which is why there is certainly a benefit, I believe, both to the contractors and to the city to have that sunset date. Now, in terms of when that may be, there have been different time periods discussed, but some period of time by which those plans will end.
And I think they left it open originally because they weren't sure based on those facts of different expenses that people had made. So now, you know, I think if you have the facts, you've got them, and we can address that on an individual basis. But if you don't, I don't see a reason to expand it for anyone else that otherwise would have, basically their facts would have expired.
And you have two issues here, don't you? You know, determining whether there's a vested interest in what the minor changes. I mean, there's so many problems that might come up under this proposed scenario, I would think.
Another issue is how do you justify that under the federal and state law? The only way I could think to justify it was this vested rights concept,
mm-hmm.
Where, okay, you know, that's out there, and that's why I think we did this in the first place. But it's just the further you go out in time, the harder it is, depending on unless there's some extraordinary facts to do it.
That's why we're trying.
We have to have staff to do that? I mean, that would be a huge time sink, I would think, for the city if we were trying to weigh in on those issues. I mean, I can't even imagine how we would staff for that.
Is there a reason we picked 7 years additional?
Just in terms of a time period by which we thought they would be dated. I mean, if you looked, you know, rules changed, obviously. This isn't something that would go on forever, so the period of 7 years was chosen. We've discussed lesser periods of time. What I think doing it this way avoids is the very argument that Councilperson Anthony is referencing, that you would have to do some fact analysis to determine whether or not somebody is actually vested. We would have some period of time by which these projects will simply just end. We don't have to get into looking at a case-by-case basis and determining whether or not legally that you are vested in that particular project. It takes all that out of it.
Next provision.
The last one, it is a minor issue, at least from the group. I think the commission may address this one differently. This simply had to do the application. This is within the exceptions of linear strip or ribbon construction. And I think this was an argument, and I'll let Mr. Gephardt speak to this if he would like to more. It was just a question of whether or not the city had the obligation to comply with the same provisions that the contractors did. There was some concern that, in fact, by having that language, it accepted out projects that the city may be involved with. I have talked to Kavanaugh about this. I certainly understand his position, but I think that was the concern.
Kavanaugh?
My position, actually, this came as an original request from the change from the Stormwater Commission to include it. As to whether stormwater applies to the city or not, I think it does, and that's been my opinion. If over an acre, yeah, it applies to us. So what I did was, I thought maybe putting in a fiber optic cable line or doing something like that that would meet this, again, not an exception, but this exemption that's qualified. I said, okay, well, we can add that in there. It seemed like it was okay, but I don't think that, I don't think it's that helpful to the city. I mean, it could be gotten rid of. I think our opinion was is we didn't really need it. There might be this small time frame where it might be useful to someone or the city on a maintenance repair type project underneath an acre. Because what I said in here was this, is in compliance with state and federal laws are exempt from the provision in this article. Well, you have to be in compliance to be exempt, so you can't really be exempt unless you meet those qualifiers. That was the best I could do in a compromise to make it work. I don't think it's that important for the city. I think the city would be willing to strike it out completely. But I think after having discussions, that was thought that, well, there might be some other usefulness to that beyond just to the city. Not so much with the commission, but with some of the other folks that we had talked with. That's my memory.
So would you be in agreement to striking the whole entire C?
I'm sorry?
If the C were struck in its entirety.
Again, I'd like Mr. Gephardt to speak to that one specifically, but I don't see that as much of a problem, that provision.
Gephardt, why don't you tell us? Pardon me? Strike it?
Nice agreement. Thanks,
Council. Let's work back the other way. I do have copies of the statute I was referencing, if anybody would like to have those.
Any questions from Council, Mr.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Gephardt.
Yes, thank you. My name is Jay Gephardt. I'm a civil engineer, and I own a business called a Civil Group here in Columbia, and I'm also a member of the Stormwater Advisory Commission, and I'm just a member, but Aaron Daugherty is the chairperson, was unable to make it today, so I'm filling in for her. I prepared this talking points that's in front of you. I thought this was a better way to present this to you guys and kind of keep this simple. If you look through these, you see the commission agrees with a lot, but we also have on the definition of redevelopment and the definition of site, we kind of differ with the previous group. We came at it a different way. You get this definition of redevelopment, and you get into the subdivision clause. It causes a lot of problems, as you guys kind of heard. And what it does effectively is anything that you have to plat for various other city regulations. Now, it may be a perfectly good redevelopment project. And again, the Stormwater Advisory Commission looked at this as a way to encourage redevelopment or not penalize it, because there is a penalty now under the current ordinance for redevelopments. And it was stymieing in redevelopment projects. So we looked at this as how can we encourage that type of thing. And so when you look at that, you could have a perfectly good redevelopment project. Meets in everyone's mind, it would be a redevelopment project. But because it wasn't a legal lot, by definition of a lot in the city regulations, you would have to plat to correct that. Well, when you plat it, now you're not a redevelopment project under stormwater ordinance. So we see that as a problem. We don't want to leave the subdivision clause in so people can circumvent and get around the ordinance. So we came up with a different way of looking at this, and said, well, if you look at the definition of site, and Mr. McGovern provided the definition of facility, activity, all that, and those are the words that Kavanaugh has problems with. But what we really want one is make it the disturbed area. That's the site. That's the project. Whatever you disturb, that's it. If it's greater than an acre, it's less than an acre. It doesn't matter about lot lines. It doesn't matter about ownership anymore. All those issues go away when you talk about disturbed area. So now you don't need a subdivision clause. So that's why the Stormwater Advisory Commission on the definition of redevelopment proposes to eliminate that language altogether, because we recommend a different definition of site that is one of disturbed area. And there's further changes that we're not talking about in the ordinance here that go back to the disturbed area now. And the reason, or the backing of the documentation for a disturbed area, is that's what the state requires and that's what the EPA requires. So we're not doing anything different. And in my outline, I'll let staff speak for themselves, but it is easier to regulate when you use the lot size. And you say, okay, the lot is greater than an acre, so in your redevelopment, so you got to do these things. Or it's less than an acre and you do these. That's easier to do. So what we tried to do to solve that problem is the commission recommended language in the ordinance that says we're going to stake these disturbed areas and we're going to show them on the plans. And we're going to provide that calculation. And if the contractor gets outside of that staked area or that the area that's shown is disturbed, then he's in violation and the ordinances that apply would apply. And so we're coming at this a little different. We really don't want to get into this discussion about 6 months from now. We don't want to talk about platting, because platting is a whole different animal. We're talking about stormwater, and we're trying to encourage redevelopment. And and the best way I can describe this is we have a net that we're trying to catch, and stormwater Commission took the position that we want all the redevelopment projects to get through the holes in that net. We don't want to catch any and cause them more expense to follow the development, regular greenfield development requirements. Staff's net has a finer mesh to it, and so we're afraid that there will be perfectly good projects that won't be able to happen because they get caught in things like the subdivision clause. And by going to the disturbed area, we hope that, and I think everyone in this room agree, it's impossible to write an ordinance that will be perfect. But we wanted to err on the side to encourage rather than discourage.
Fox?
Just briefly, I think you've heard some of the things I've said before, but one of the issues is when you do just disturbed area only, obviously it's very hard to figure out common scheme of development and or for sale, because that can associate non-disturbed areas, which I understand what the arguments there are. Another issue was the replatting. Well, originally one of the many, many, many drafts ago before we even got out of staff talking about it was originally we'd used replatting as a way to have that delineation. Well, instead of using that subdivision, because if you're not changing anything and you're not subdividing anything off, you could go in and replat, because one of the issues was a downtown area. So by making it subdivision versus replatting, we thought we covered that by saying, well, no, you could still replat and then not subdivide. That was one of the reasons we did it this way.
Subdivision is platting. Platting is subdivision. That's my argument on that. I mean, to me, there's no difference. You don't have to take a lot and cut it into two to be subdivision. A subdivision is platting of a single lot also. So that's, again, we have a larger whole net trying to encourage this instead of trying to catch things that didn't. Downtown's a perfect example. Most of these buildings down here aren't on legal lots. And if I wanted to, or if you zone it CP and we want to do a project, well, the CP ordinance requires platting. Even if it is a legal lot, you have to plat it. So by using this language of platting, every planned district will no longer be qualified as a redevelopment project. Also, by having a date certain, any project that's platted after this date will no longer ever qualify as a redevelopment project. So 20 years from now, projects that are platted next year would never be able to qualify as redevelopment. So we felt it was better just to eliminate that problem altogether and go to disturbed area. And it's common sense to think this is the area that we're disturbing. This is, that's the site.
I mean, I'll defer to staff, but my understanding in getting their input was is that subdivision means split off. I mean, in this context, and that replatting is not necessarily going to cause that, especially when you're trying to make it conform to legal lot, which is the very specific reason why we went away from replatting. And, of course, the Stormwater Commission would have never known that because it's something we caught up with staff review before they ever saw it.
Let me move on. The single family, it's basically a fairness issue with us. If you're going to exempt single family detached structures, it seems single family attached that share a common wall should be exempt also. That really just boils down to that. You get into all this legal stuff and my eyes glaze over, I kind of lose it. But for the Stormwater Advisory Commission, it was really about the basic fairness. And we think going into the future, there'll be more and more people who share a common wall. And that will be an affordable single family solution for a lot of people.
If you have questions, but I tried to address that as best I could. And then I think we allow for that on different lots, just not on one residential lot, multiple families.
The other issue is the next issue, different language. What we're trying to do is provide some definition for people. And again, you got to take this in context. This is for sites, redevelopment sites. So first, you go down the road, is it development or redevelopment? It's redevelopment. Is it greater than an acre or less than an acre? It's greater than an acre. Okay. So now we have some partial exemptions provided for sites greater than redevelopment sites greater than an acre, which John has, and I haven't seen them, but they'll be there, whatever they are. But then you also add the language to the maximum extent practicable. So it becomes from a task of trying to figure out what that is. You talked, Ms. Helen, you talked about times for the staff, but for a practicing engineer, the only way I really know what that is to take staff time, sit down on that project, and figure out what it is. It's, you know, rather than just define what it means. And we think, the commission thinks, that those changes to the manual should be talked about. I mean, you're approving an ordinance that talks about these exemptions, but you don't know what they are. You're providing 100% exemption for lots less than an acre. What exemption are you providing for lots greater than an acre? And we'd like to know what that is.
I mean, I guess, go ahead. I guess I'll just say again that the difference there is we know we can exempt anything underneath an acre, so we did for redevelopment. And then there are some limited and more flexible ways that you can meet redevelopment over an acre if you do it to the maximum extent practicable. But instead of having staff make all those determinations, we are trying to offer options.
This other last issue probably is the plan districts and existing plans approved before September 4th. There are a lot of them to answer your question, Mr. Kessepool. In my office, I could probably count off 40 or 50 of them that haven't been built yet. They're going to be around for a long time. And what happens is you don't know as an owner that if you add a drive-through where you had a parking lot before, that's a change to the plan. Okay, it's been 5 years. A lot of things have changed. The economy went to hell right about the time this ordinance got approved. A lot of things that were going to get built didn't get built. And in that five-year period, people can rethink what they want to do, and they say, oh, a drive-through would be nice here where there's a, but there's no additional impervious area created by that. But we don't know. That's not, you make a change to the plan, technically under the ordinance, now you're under the new. And we wanted to provide, and we've used the word adverse impacts, but what we're really talking about is impervious area. If you increase the impervious area from the plan that was approved before 07, on, when you revise the plan, whether it's a planned district or a open zone district, then if you increase that impervious area, then you follow the new. If you are at or less, then you follow the one that was in place when the plan was approved. And we think that's fair. And the whole sunset issue in this came about because we wanted to address, you know, okay, we got these people out there that have these approved plans, but it goes on forever. And we, out of fairness, we wanted to define what they could do on a revision, but we also wanted to limit, you know, how long they could do that. And we wanted to have it a long enough period of time so that they could have some warning to do that. The 7 years was suggested, I think, by Mr. Landre, because that's the period of a preliminary plat. If you don't plat in a portion of a preliminary plat within 7 years, then the preliminary plat went away. So he picked the 7 years, and that's where that came from. For the Stormwater Advisory Committee, it was the whole issue of adding the sunset was a fairness thing, because we're trying to create a balance between defining if you make a revision and defining that, and then providing balance to say, well, how long? You can't keep doing this forever. There's got to be an end to this at some point.
We need to put language in anywhere about impervious area. I mean, if you're going from a parking lot to a drive-through, you're not changing the amount of impervious area in that area. I mean, on the lot, or if somebody wants to put in covered parking, they're not adding any more impervious area by putting a cover up. But yet, you're still calling on the site that they've got to have stormwater management for the entire parking lot rather than just where they're changing to put in the legs for the cover.
Depends on if you're talking about sheet flow or concentrated flow. If they're putting in a gutter somewhere where it sheet flowed off, then you got something completely different. So how do you want to put it in?
There are also other exceptions for what you're talking about that we actually tried to include, where you're talking about if it's, and John adjusted this up, land disturbances of less than 10,000 square feet that did not create more than 500 square feet of additional impervious surface, well, that's going to be also accepted. What we're really talking about here is plans from the past. So if it's a preliminary plat, 5 years has already expired off of those seven, maximum 2 years left. And then what you have is the issue with changes is, I don't see how this argument works where I have a vested right in my change document. You either had a vested right because you took substantial steps to complete the project, which is the only way I see that you can have this, you know, this exemption supported, or you didn't. I mean, the problem is if you want to come in and change, well, when do you lose your vesting, and then you would lose the whole exception that would justify it in the first place.
And our argument is you should be able to move a sign on a site or change, take the same building and twist it on the site, not increasing impervious area, and still have those vested rights.
A sign on the site I don't think typically is going to change the runoff coefficients, but changing the building around and moving things on the site probably would. And then you had an option. Your option was you could either do it the way you originally had planned it, or you can do it under the current regulations. Or in this case, for 6 months, you could do it under either.
I think I tend to agree with what Mr. Dudley said. If you're not increasing the impervious area, you shouldn't have to go to the new plan. If the impervious area stays the same as your original plat. Now I have a question. If I have a driveway, I'm just theoretical, if I have a driveway that's asphalt and it crumbles away and I replace it with concrete, am I redevelopment, maintenance, or am I under new stormwater?
Well, first of all, are you under an acre? If you're under an acre, it's definitely maintenance.
Okay, I'm under an acre. What if I'm over an acre?
And if you're over an acre, you get into some questions about it.
But I'm not increasing the impervious surface at all. It's the same size, the same dimensions. All I did was change it from asphalt to concrete.
You can get into some of the really hard ones. So what's the difference between concrete and asphalt? So if you rip up the concrete because it was concrete and you get down to the dirt, do you have to do a land disturbance if it's over an acre? Well, arguably you do. Now, when you mill up the asphalt, does that disturb the land or not? You could argue it.
If you ripped the parking lot out and replaced it with concrete and it was over an acre, you would have to do the stormwater ordinance requirements, but there would be partial exemptions to that since it's redevelopment.
That's right.
But my point is I did not increase the impervious surface at all.
Oh, right. And I think one of the options is you can do a 10% reduction. So you can make it 10% better for the total site over the over an acre. There are two other options where they do, depending on the site disturbed or depending on the site hole, so you can either bring it up slowly based on the amount you change, or you could bring it up all at once to try to cover your whole site. So some of the options are, if you're really impervious, maybe you only want to take a little chip away at it and make it a little better. Or if you really want to do more things and set things out for yourself for the future because you're going to phase in different developments, maybe you want to do the right coefficient number and do it all at once. So I think that was the way to kind of try to do that with water quality. Give some flexibility to it.
I have a question related to Mr. Gebhardt's recommendation that if you don't change the impervious surface, that you make a change that doesn't change impervious surface. But you were saying, depending on how, what the change is, it could change the runoff.
Right.
So even though you don't change the amount of impervious surface, it could substantially affect the runoff.
Change the way the characteristics of it flowing off.
But it would still comply with the original management plan that was in place.
Well, not necessarily.
But because it's agreed to, your plan was approved under that original stormwater, so you'd have to comply with that.
There's a variety of those different plans and the details kind of associated with them. So sometimes it does look like it will comply, and sometimes it don't. It's a fact determination, which it goes back to the original thing of, is it vested or not? I mean, to me, that's the critical distinction, because otherwise, how do you have this exception at all? There's no exception in the federal or state law for this. The only way I think you could have justified it was the vested right idea, and that's fact dependent. So if you at best have 2 years left on some of these vested rights, then you'd have to show those substantial steps and those types of things.
Like a definition of disturbed area? What does that mean?
To me, it would be, you know, disturbed ground. I mean, the vegetation is stripped.
If I run a bulldozer across a piece of ground, I disturb the area?
Only if you strip the grass off of it as you go.
Also, in the manual, they have these different things with these curve numbers. And some of the curve numbers are either based off of kind of this average curve number or individual things that are impervious or not impervious, and there gets into these kind of arguments about these curve numbers. But you can actually try to evaluate the site by its imperviousness to different curve numbers and then come up with different results. And it's beyond me. The engineers are better at battling than talking about that.
The last issue that's a new issue for you all is really not something we want you to deal with today. It's just kind of put you on notice. The maintenance, there's a lot of money being spent on these best management practices by small businesses and development in Columbia. And they're there for a reason and for a purpose, and they should be maintained. And they should be maintained like they're supposed to. And that's right now being put onto the owners of the property to maintain. There's inspection requirements. Every time it rains, they're supposed to fill out an inspection report and inspect these things. We agreed with Mr. Mathis back in December that this is not something that we can address now. But when you talk about a large Walmart facility or something like that, it's easy to get your head around the homeowner or the property owner taking care of these things. But when you get into residential developments, where you've got 40 lots that have a common area with a wet detention pond or some type of thing. It's on a common area lot. It's owned by the homeowners association. And the cost of maintenance of that may be more than those property owners are willing to pay per year. Ann.
So who are you recommending take them if the homeowners don't? Who are you recommending would do the maintenance?
We have to figure that out, Helen. And sure. I'm not saying it's necessarily the city's issue, but it's an issue because I see homeowner associations just walking away from the ground that they're on, and then the city will end up with that maintenance eventually because they'll just walk away and let the land go to tax sale. let the homeowner association dissolve and go away. And I think there's a problem here that needs to be solved in the future. There needs to be a way that these things are maintained and provide the purpose they are. My experience with this is Bearfield Meadows. I did it in 99. It was one of the first ones that did these. And there's, I get a lot of neighbors out there calling me and wanting to tear these things out, get rid of them. They're an eyesore, their dogs get in, you know, all kinds of issues, and they just want to remove them. They're expensive to maintain.
But they do maintain them right now.
Not really. They just let it go. It's nature. So some of these BMPs, though, you can't really get away with that very long. Pervious pavement is a good example. I don't know how you clean it. I think you all have a fire station that has it over on Green Meadows, and I think the firemen use power washers to clean it. But it's a difficult issue, and all the Stormwater Advisory Commission is trying to do is put it out there for you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any comments by council? Let me ask this, and would it be appropriate to ask the Mr. Gebhardt and Mr. McGovern if they want the ordinance amended to give us a list of specific amendments in their language rather than us struggle with the language Monday night and give us that preferably before the weekend so we can look at it? Is that reasonable to expect?
Well, if we're voting it up or down, I think we need to know what it is we are voting up or down. And so, yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Well, yeah, we could let our counselor look at the amendments to make sure they're written properly, because we don't want to be struggling wording these amendments Monday night.
But it's not only asking, I mean, yes, to ask staff to do anything but to look at them, but, you know, they've been looking at all these changes, not only for legality, but, you know, we have to comply with EPA requirements. I mean, we can't ask them to sign off or say they're all right. So I'm not wondering why we're asking them even to look at them.
Let me summarize as briefly as I can. December, we met. We had 10 things we were trying to work on. So we'd done a lot of work. We put an item on agenda. Council asked us to take a look. We went back. We came up with a list of 10. Of those 10, I think staff has moved, as far as we know how, on, I think, 9 of those 10 things, by my count. And then, so we meet again in April. We talk about those. They weren't quite resolved at that point. And there were 2 new items on the table, one of which we're trying to accomplish with the language that's in front of you. So out of the 12 items, 10 of them have some sort of movement from the staff's perspective toward what we were asked for from the folks having to spend the money. So I view that as a pretty good working relationship. I know, you know, these things are always conflict laden. It's a lot of effort on everyone's part to get to this point. Certainly open to seeing any new language that comes in. But we do have an ordinance that we'll have and we'll bring back and welcome any language items that come forward in that time frame. But I think we'd be looking at the 4th.
The meeting's the 4th.
Meeting's the 4th.
So but if they want it before the weekend and if they want it as part of the packet, we're going to have everything before noon on Thursday.
Yeah. So why are we just getting a list?
Well, it could be emailed to us. I mean, I just want it before the weekend.
But I don't think it's fair of us to ask the staff to sign off on those changes or make I think we should just receive them. The staff's already made themselves clear. And the only thing we've agreed to do is strike Section 12A87C, and it stands on its own. So either we vote it up or down. I think they can't make themselves any clearer.
What I want to do is make the legal.
Then we're talking a lot longer than June 4th.
My feeling is we're pretty well there on what I've heard. Okay. You know, a lot of the discussion I heard was really describing the argument, I guess. I wouldn't say an argument. The intellectual process we went through, talking about how we could get where we were, and I think, you know, we are pretty close on most of it. That's my sense. Folks may disagree.
Okay, so we have a process to approach this for the rest of this week and over the weekend, and we'll be able to deal with this Monday night. Any other comments by council or staff?
I have something unrelated to ask. I need to meet with council in a closed session to discuss contracts under negotiation. So I was hoping we might be able to find a time this Thursday. Not here.
I won't be here on Thursday.
You will or won't? I won't either.
Here on the weekend.
I'm not going to be here on the weekend.
I just want to say thank you to everybody that came in today.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. Well, Monday, what time are we starting?
Monday.
How much time do you need, Mike? An hour or 30 minutes?
I think it may spark some discussion. I'd say an hour.
Well, we have a pre-council meeting. Do you want to piggyback on front of that? Want to go to 5?
I forget the content of the pre-council.
How about tomorrow, Mike?
We can't do it tomorrow because of notice requirements.
We have to have 24 hours.
Yeah.
What?
And I won't
because
be
of notice
tomorrow.
Requirements.
Oh, okay.
Let me, Sheila, do you remember what the pre-council topic is?
Yes, it's planning, notification, community development stuff.
Right.
Which I don't know if Tim knows is on it.
Can you push that back?
That's all right. Can we push that back? We'll just have a closed session.
I don't think there was an urgency. I mean, right. Other than we'd like to get it
6 done. 6 o'clock. Need a motion to have a closed session?
Can't make a motion here.
I'll take
we'll,
that as consensus.
We'll post notice, and then at the time, at 6 o'clock, you can vote to go into closed session.
Okay.
That's perfect timing.
Do it that way.
Thank you.
Nice job on the state of the city.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I'll see you right
now. Tony Messina.
You want to see it right now?
Tony Messina.
You want to see it right now?